Welcome to Farmer Talk Radio. This podcast is focused on key learnings for manufacturing cancer cell-based immunotherapies to help accelerate process and development from the 2024 Immuno-Oncology 360 Conference. For more information on the IO 360 Conference, editorial, podcasts, or webcasts, you can visit io360summit.com or theconferenceforum.org. Thank you and enjoy the podcast.
We have a panel that is going to have a robust, provocative, and I hope concise conversation. So could I call everyone up? So we have Jessica Carmen from Kinsel Bio, Angela Chen from WuXi, Shishir Gadam from Cargo Therapeutics, Arvind Natarajan from Iovance, and Greg Rosati from Century. And I want to pick out two words from Christine's presentation, which was manufacturing matters. It really matters. So Peter Marks has said in conventional drugs, the IND is 20%, 80% clinical and 20% CMC. But in cell and gene therapy, that's reverse. That it's 20% clinical and 80% CMC. So why does manufacturing matter? And with the six CAR T, one TIL, I think four gene modified stem cell therapies, there is a backlog in manufacturing. If you make what you think is an insignificant change, it might not be insignificant. It might have significant effects that you don't realize until you've conducted a series of clinical trials. So we have a series of questions and a short period of time. And maybe I'm going to start with this. And the idea is we have many, many things that we have preclinical data on that have an impact on manufacturing or potentially could have an impact in manufacturing. Writing a book chapter last year together with one of our graduate students, I had a list of 40, okay? And those are gene knockouts, they're cytokine additions, they're metabolomic. Anyone can do this math in their head? What's 2 to the 40th? So what combination, right? It's a trillion. So how do you do that, right? And how do we make these improvements is something we're going to be discussing. So we'll start with Jessica because she gave me the analogy here. And we were talking about what does it take to make this leap to a newer technology? You're in the middle of a clinical trial. You see something that's going to be making an impact, or maybe it doesn't, and you said what we need is not faster horses. So maybe you want to tell us what you mean by that, and we'll ask a couple of the others to chime in on that.
So, yeah, people would have asked for faster horses. And I think that's kind of the rut we're in right now in the field. If you go into the exhibit hall, you'll see lots of different technologies out there, and people are like, that's great, I want a Prodigy. And so what is it going to take to actually start seeing some of these technologies out there that are actually start becoming incorporated into cell therapy processes? And I mean, I just think it's a provocative question, and I don't know the answer. But as a manufacturer, it is frustrating when people come in and they ask for the same platform over and over. Nobody's asking for the new technologies, sadly. What is it going to take, I think?
So without naming names, does anyone else want to comment on that question? What does it take to make the leap?
So I'll take I'll give you my two cents on this. I think the key question is one of, how early do you want to make that investment, right? Because there's always going to be a trade-off between potentially losing a signal that you see with your current technology with whatever's existing. Whatever's existing also has the sort of advantage of possibly having cleared a BLA, so you know it's been accepted by regulators. So the path to commercialization is clearer, although it may be the end result may be more expensive or more challenging, but at least you have a path to getting to that finish line. So in a certain sense, it goes back to almost a a choice that a company makes or a group makes in terms of investing early because they believe in that particular technology, or because they've already established a line of sight to assuming that the product is eventually going to work from a clinical standpoint. So at least in my experience, what I've seen is that the first generation product that comes through tends to be sort of, well established in terms of the technology, with the expectation that the next generation product, whether it's an add-on or even an adjunct product, similar to some of the discussions we saw before, may have a little bit more latitude in terms of incorporating new technologies. I'll use one frame of reference. With the first CAR-Ts, there was a lot of discussion on the choice of the bioreactor, between which bioreactor to use to grow the cells, static versus dynamic and so on. So overall, you use the example of the Prodigy. Back then, Prodigy was the big unknown, whereas today it's been more or less fairly well accepted. So I see sort of this next generation technology coming in as part of either risk takers taking that leap of faith into that and making that early investment, or the next generation product coming through after the first generation has been established.
But there are countercurrents, aren't there, Shishir? So as a manufacturing experts, you have a new technology, I have a new technology, Greg, Angela, Jessica, but the clinical and the commercial team says, well, what we're using is working. Let's go with that because we know we can get approval sooner. So what does it take to convince the skeptics with a pending pivotal trial, for example, to take a look? And what's the criteria for evaluation?
Yeah, I'll chime in. I think the first and foremost, you have to define what is it that you're solving for. You'll often see, amplification of a particular problem. Point of care is the solution to everything, or integrated devices is the solution to everything. In reality, what you're solving for is, you heard from Kristen, product profile, preserving clinical signal, and then a clear line of sight with a path of commercialization that Arvind mentioned. The other thing I would mention is, I think there's a ton of appetite to opt into this. It's framing what you're solving for, it's line of sight for commercialization, and lastly, I would say freedom to operate. Many times these new technologies come with nebulous arrangements of licensing and opt-in, and sponsors want freedom to operate and full control of their product and process knowledge. So I think if you keep those three principles in front, I think you'll generate a lot of interest.
So next question to pick up on that point, and I know Greg has a particular answer to this, so I won't ask it of him first. So Angela and others, what are the top three things that you can do to remove the impact of human variability on manufacturing?
I can take the first one, easiest, automation. We are just way too many manual processes in the cell therapy, which is inevitable. Everything starts with, human efforts and to get the things. But now with autologous, we're not going to treat 30, 40 patients. Now we're talking about autoimmune, which is 1,000. So how we really imply the automation. So the automation of analytics, automation of the sample collection, automation of everything. So I think that was the one biggest challenge to this industry, and also together with all the efforts that we have to work on.
Greg, are iPSC the be-all and all to removing variability?
I don't want to make a plug for iPSCs necessarily, but I think they do solve a problem in that you start with a clonal population that has all the edits you want, and you're going to have much less heterogeneity from batch to batch, but you can still have human error. So I think everyone is very much biased by the world we live in now, where these autologous CAR-Ts have had approvals, but there's a whole another wave of types of cell therapies coming. So I guess we got to think about all those things. But I guess when it comes to human error, I guess the stakes are highest with autologous because if you don't deliver, sometimes the patient dies, right? So that's a big problem where you just don't have enough product to do it again. But human error is a problem no matter where you go. So I think automation is one answer, but I also say simplification. And maybe I know you're going to get to tech transfer later. The other piece is not minimizing the shoulder-to-shoulder tech transfer, because so many times you think you have things in writing on a batch record that's clear, but it's not clear because there's so many interpretations. So I think you have to have a real close collaboration between your initial developers and then your operators and then your operators and your next set of operators. So just, it has to be total clarity on what you're doing.
Yeah, thanks. And Arvind,
maybe add one more point to this discussion.
Yeah, let's say you don't believe in iPSC and you have a TIL product. Tell us about the variability.
So I actually completely agree with the sentiments that both Greg and Angela mentioned. The other piece that I'd add on from a sort of a classical developmental opportunity is really to understand the points of failure for the process. You know, the process robustness studies and truly understanding what is critical or what could go wrong and how, you know, if something went wrong, how would you identify it early enough or what corrective actions could you put in to try and recover the product from you know, the difference between an in-spec versus an out-of-spec product. Those, you know, identifying those points of failures, putting in engineering controls wherever possible to mitigate those, making sure that those are detectable and potentially actionable, those would go a long way in terms of moving sort of classical human error points of failure, because your administrative controls will only get you so far. I agree wholeheartedly with the importance of tech transfer and that shoulder-to-shoulder passing out on that knowledge, but if you can try and design the process to minimize the number of sort of key aspects that have to be considered each and every time, that would be a, you know, one of the elements for the recipe for success.
Anyone else want to chime in on human variability?
I was just going to. He stole the words from my mouth. Minimal manipulations. Get as close to what you would think an in vivo process would look like, but do it ex vivo. I think if you engine, you can automate, but you know, Bill Gates once said, there's no point automating inefficiency in your process, right? So you really want to engineer out non-value manipulations.
Any step that is open to human interpretation is an opportunity for error, right? So automation isn't always possible in every step, but anytime you can eliminate the human standing there saying, now did they mean this or did they mean that, that's where the error is going to come in.
Okay, so let's talk about new technologies now and integrating new technologies. Jessica, you mentioned bioreactors, but we also have new reagents and materials, new approaches, other equipment, analytics for manufacturing. What do you most want to see? So where's the biggest gap? Or gaps. Angela, you want to start us off there?
Yeah, I can think about two things, you know, because we're CDMO, we have our hands on multiple ends of the projects. So the two things that we collected from the team is the first one, well-characterized reagents that can directly put into patients. So I think this industry was not up to that speed yet. So we definitely wanted, you know, all the vendors to think about how to put the, you know, materials, reagents way early and to characterize well enough. And the second is for the analytical, because CGT analytical is very important. And right now we inherited a lot of things from small molecule to large molecule. So what the ideal analytical instruments or method will be is use as little volume as possible. Those guys knows how much is it, you know, it costs to produce one batch of the sample, and that goes to the human being for treatment and to save life. But you need to have, you know, all sorts of you know, assay to wait for taking all those amount of the sample for testing. So little as much the sample volume. Second is turnaround time. So some of the assay takes 28 days. You know, our entire manufacturer couldn't wait for that. So that's the second thing. And the third most important thing is we ideally wanted to have one assay can read multiple end results so that we can save sample volume and shorten the turnaround time, and also convince the regulatory that those data make sense. So I think that those are the collective answer from my team.
I think, Bruce, you know, so much has been talked about minimizing vein-to-vein time and turnaround time, rapid expansions. But it's really pointless if you have a two-day process and a 10-day QC. That's one. Number two, it's also pointless to have a 10 million dose if you need 300 million cells for the QC. So I think the metric for manufacturing process needs to be much more holistic in nature, looking at testing and process. And testing is somewhat, frankly, forgotten. And I think the innovation needs to happen more in testing, in my mind.
So what is on your analytics wish list? Magic wand.
Magic wand, next-gen sequence multi-attribute assays in less than 24 hours, right? Seriously, because let the process be driven by the profile and the dose and the expansion characteristics, and really innovate on QC. Maybe this is more for the autologous context, you know, and it's a little bit different in the allogenic context, it's a little easier on that regard, but I think that's the magic wand. I think it's coming, and I have seen some good work coming on the horizon, so.
So I can comment on the allogeneic world if you like in a minute, but I lived in the autologous space for a while until about 4 years ago. So I guess maybe just to think about that a little bit more. So to me, the bottleneck to release is now the rapid sterility methods, which are like 5 or 6 days if you use CO2 evolution as the marker. So then you want to get to some sort of next-gen sequencing perhaps. Can it be done? Right? Because I'm 4 years removed from this, so maybe things have changed. But if you're looking for sequences that are indicative of a wide enough array of bacteria and fungi, you're going to get too many false positives, right? And if you go too narrow, the FDA is going to say fine, but still do some USP, which I believe the next gen or the CO2 evolution methods aren't USP now. So you're not going to win either way. Are there methods out there? I can throw it out to the audience. Are there methods out there? Don't give me a sales.
Yeah, someone can correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't thioglycolate mentioned in the CFR? I mean, how many decades has that been in use? And there has to be something better, right?
There does. But even today, we have to, any new method that you bring in, you have to demonstrate, equivalency to the compendial methods. So that's a must-have at this point, right? So there's also some, I guess, evolution that has to happen on the regulatory front. I'll just add one counterpoint to what Shishir said in terms of the analytics. I look at analytics within two frameworks. One is a narrower framework of those analytics that are required for release of product. The second is a much broader list of analytics that are required to have better understanding or better characterization of the product. And clearly, the regulatory requirements for the former are going to be much more stringent for the latter, right? At a minimum, you need validated methods in addition to, you know, the other considerations such as sample volume and turnaround time that others have spoken about. So while I wish that we got this, this magical 24-hour assay that really tells us what's in the, you know, all the attributes of the product, ultimately that could also be a nightmare scenario where you're trying to meet now specifications for 100 different things, where just by, you know, sheer chance, you're going to, you know, be out of spec, right? So that balance also has to be in there.
Yeah. So Angela and Jessica, you're both at CDMOs, and you can talk about your wish list, but I want to ask it this way. So you have your established methods, manufacturing and analytical. You have a customer come in to you with a process, be it manufacturing, analytical, or both, that you know is suboptimal. But they're saying, all the work we've done is with this machine.
This never happens, by the way.
So what is your presentation or counter argument to them?
We present how we would approach it, and you know what we think, you know, good looks like, and what looks good for phase appropriate development. So we don't favor focusing on a commercial-ready process early, because that would require a lot of investment and work early, which, if the product is going to fail in the clinic, would have been a waste. So we focus on phase-appropriate development. So we do suggest that they invest as heavily as possible in analytics in the beginning, while focusing on a phase-appropriate process development.
Yeah, so I agree with all Jessica's saying. But on top of that, some of the basic information I wanted to make sure. So process, you know, we wanted to do tech transfer. But to my words, I wanted to say translation. So, you know, understanding the translation from a development stage process to a GMP actually requires a lot of things that usually being overlooked. So, you know, people always say, oh, why? It's just I hand over a batch record to you, just repeat it. So there is a tons of documentation, misinterpretation. So I would emphasize this more about communication and the training and the documentation. Those things look very commonly accepted, but unfortunately, because this industry moves so fast, we tend to forget all those things are pretty critical. So especially the, you know, we're talking about the technology transfer shoulder to shoulder, but some of the time, even shoulder to shoulder, right? Why don't you just sit down and look at the video together? So a lot of things needs to be think creative and also adapt into the current situation. And rather than 1,000 pages of a batch record, let the two teams visibly see the process and understand what does that mean in those of the languages. I think those are, you know, overlooked, but very important.
Yeah, great. So we want also to be able to take questions from the audience. And, yeah, there's one.
All right, thank you. Couple questions. First, to your panel. Can you comment on the FDA new guidance on the quality assurance for the cell gene therapy that just, I think, published end of last year compared to the old ones, old versions back in 2011, and especially on the cellular CAR T, especially CAR T functional assay, is this a requirement? It's, you know, your ultimately you see the killing of that. How do you see that you know, implement into your manufacturing? Second question, actually, I have a question for Christine Hayes. You have a I see your last slides about. Oh, the four T's, right? The first one is T-cell fitness. Can you comment specifically what are you looking at as fitness, parameters for fitness? Thank you.
Okay, who would like to take the guidance question?
Is this the January 24 document that just came out a month ago? Yeah, it's, I mean, and the original draft came out, I believe, March 2022, right? It's been 2 years. Then they responded to a number of public comments. I think it's a fantastic document, very well written, has a very nice section on comparability, has a very nice section on gene editing, testing. With respect to the, you know, they also comment on the secondary malignancy risks and things of those nature that they've been talking about. With respect to the potency assay, you know, they've been very consistent on their expectation that you want to introduce a functionally meaningful potency assay early in development, and many first-gen CAR T companies, I think, struggle with that. I think the good thing is, you know, they're clear. You don't necessarily need multiple orthogonal assays. You need one functional assay, and you could have, you know, an interferon gamma release type of an assay and a cytotox assay for characterization. I think something to just, and I don't know if the guidance speaks to it or not, but really I think, just specificity of your antigen targets and making sure that the potency signal is specific to your target and mechanism of action is key. So maybe, Greg, you can add.
I think the guidances are never going to really be perfect. You know, this field is moving too fast. So I'm happy they've been updated because I think some versions, maybe not the 2011, but I don't know guidances that well, I'll be honest, because I don't worry too much about them. I just think about logically understanding what the general requirements are, but then applying scientific logic to that. So, for example, a lot of the guidance has been written in the context of autologous CAR T and vector, for example, and gene editing components. You have to now have everything be GMP and validated. Well, in the iPSC world, we use our editing components once, and then we make a clone and we never go back and edit again. So why would I possibly care about validating the process that made that editing component? I don't care. And I've told the FDA that, and they agree. But, however, I need to know what that component is, where it came from, in terms of tracking and sourcing, to make sure that I don't bring risk into, or the risk I do bring, if there are animal components that came from that, I understand what that risk is, and I test for it appropriately. So I think it's just really a matter of taking what guidance is out there, figuring out what applies to you, what doesn't apply to you, and then understanding the spirit of the law, not the letter of the law, and then adapting it accordingly.
And while we're on this topic, Shishir mentioned potency, and it has been a struggle because of the complexities of a cellular therapy, and especially a gene-modified cellular therapy, to make that correlation with the clinical response, especially early on in development. And then there's the confounder of, as Kristen mentioned, and Christine, what's happening in vivo is really the indicator, right? Cell expansion, naive and stem cell memory and central memory. So how do we think about potency for the clinical effect? But I would flip it a little bit, because we want to talk about tech transfer and comparability, and I think that's a real need in tech transfer and comparability, is using a potency and even a correlative potency assay for the tech transfer. So would like to, Arvind, you've done tech transfer, so why don't we start with you?
No, that's a great question. So in terms of considerations for tech transfer eventually leading to comparability, things of that nature, really ultimately having a defendable analytical characterization package is a must-have. And going back to what I said in a discussion for an earlier question, I think the analytical characterization package has to be thought of, again, in two buckets. One is your release attributes. That includes the potency that ultimately will lead to specifications. And then, more importantly, you'll also have the extended characterization. And here, trying to understand how the process inputs are then translated into the analytical outcomes, and having that clear understanding link between the process and the analytics, and how to interpret the outcomes becomes critical, right? At least for the field of autologous cell therapy, we have the additional huge confounding factor of variability in starting material. It's very rare that you're able to get enough starting material to truly be able to distinguish process variability, analytical variability from starting material variability. And so that frequently confounds the both the success of tech transfers, as well as making sure that when something doesn't go as expected, you can try and diagnose what happened. Was it part of the tech transfer, or was it the starting material, or something else? So there's a very clear interdependency between the two. I absolutely agree with what Angela said. Start with analytics, because unless you have a good measurement system, you don't know what you're measuring. And then after that, it just becomes everybody's favorite hypothesis, and you can go down, your favorite rabbit hole. So.
Let me add, though, quickly, Arvind, the variability coming from the starting material, you can take that off the table by splitting the donors, and that's what the agency expects. So you can actually do control tech transfers and comparability. The challenge comes from powering it statistically. So doing it enough number of times to have equivalence criteria that actually can show that when controlled for the starting material, the process variability is within control and gives a meaningful product profile at both sites. And especially if you're doing it with one CDMO to another CDMO, that's particularly harder just in terms of execution. So I think the concept and principles are well laid out. I think the execution is hard.
If I could just add to that, yeah, I agree. I think splitting donor material when you're doing a tech transfer example is a really nice methodology. I think the harder thing is when you're doing routine manufacturing and strange things happen, how do you know what the cause is? So I think that's where data analytics, correlative analysis becomes so powerful. So I know there's a vision at Big Pharma. I don't know what's happened in the last 4 years, but I know when I left, this was the plan, which was to
correlate patient parameters, understanding as much as you can about the apheresis, and then the isolated T cells, and then the process parameters, the product attributes, the clinical outcomes, the translational data, and looking for correlates of analysis. And the perfect solution would then be, this patient, I already know before I even process, is going to behave this way, so I tweak my process so that I can still get the same product. So I don't know if others want to comment on that, if that's a reality or not, or if it's becoming a reality, but I think that's ultimately would be the goal.
So I believe Arvin has worked on two FDA-approved cell therapies, but I'll ask this of the others, and for Angela and Jessica, the answer might be one, ours, but how many cell therapy manufacturing sites should a commercial cell therapy company have?
I'm 4 years removed from autologous, so for allogeneic, you can get away with one.
Okay, I've done three approvals, so I'll comment on this. So I'm exhausted from this, right? Not one, but not more, not a lot, right? And you hear the terms redundancy of supply. I don't know that it's really about redundancy of supply. What it is really about is reliability of supply. You never have redundancy, right? You at the end of the day, so you can configure this from a geography perspective, you can configure this from a perspective of platforms and technology, but what you're really, I mean, you can have situations where if you have a single site, you do need redundancy because even an annual plant shutdown could stop treating patients. I mean, that's just not right, right? So you need two for sure, right? I think more than that, I think you have to think about, and I know Arvind can comment on it, you have to think about hub and spoke type of structures where you could probably centralize certain parts of the process and then decentralize other parts of the process and then perhaps look at a hybrid model for testing. So there's no one answer, but you have to break down your entire vein-to-vein journey, centralize parts of it, and decentralize some parts of it.
Great. So one more question, and then we'll go back to the audience. Shishir, you mentioned redundancy, and I'd like to ask Angela and Jessica to think about this one. Let's talk about redundancy and monopolies, specifically in supply chain or sole source reagents that your process is critically dependent on. How do you think about establishing a backup and let's say the technology is or isn't there, or there may be a substitute that you could validate, but how are you thinking about that for your cell therapy manufacturing?
Yeah, I think this is a very, you know, we have been living through this COVID, and the multiple of the program got really, really, you know, dangerous, risky during some of the session, simply because we're competing some of the resource going for the vaccine production. So, you know, that says, I think the three, I wanted to summarize the three risks from our CGT supply chain. One is accessibility. You know, when we are still, you know, $1 million procurement is huge compared to those like 10, 20, 100 million, you know, big customers for vaccine production, we're little. So accessibility to those, you know, reserved products is always a limit. Second is scalability. Now you are thinking someone specifically designed for cell therapy, starting from a PD material, moving for the early phase, but they are just not quickly ramp up into scalability that can support multinational GMP, you know, trials and everything. So that is scalability. Third part, because of those two things, the price. The price is way high for this industry. So those are the three very unique, you know, I would say supply chain risk that we're facing. But, you know, as a CDMO, we still should be, you know, help in this industry. So we start to collect multiple second vendors, second source, and to do those comparability study based on our, you know, because we're having multiple, you know, projects ongoing, so we can do more comparable than anyone else, which is our unique. And we plan to take off all those confidentiality and also get the consensus from our client and make those data available or making those data to be accessible to other people so that the other vendors or other clients don't have to repeat those assays, don't have to repeat, and also then we have a multiple choice so that for anyone to do those options. So we wanted to, you know, I really like this reliable, but reliable is also very costly. You know, you cannot store hundred materials in the warehouse because they simply expired. Second, they, you know, sometimes it's just you cannot have enough storage to store. So those are the all critical problems that we're facing.
Yeah, Jessica.
Yeah, so one way that Kinsella is addressing this is by focusing on immunotherapies, so CAR-T, CAR-NK, CAR-macrophage primarily, in order to not have to have a laundry list of vendors and materials and supplies that we need to keep in stock, and having supplies that can be used for multiple clients at a time so that we try to this doesn't reduce the risk, but it certainly mitigates it. It also will help with running through the supplies more quickly so you don't have to worry about shelf life too much. But I think your question of, you know, what happens when you have a sole provider, that's a tricky question and depends, of course, on the shelf life of the product and how accessible it is. And if there's a big company out there that's going to gobble it all up so that the rest of us are really struggling to get it, because that happens. But trying to streamline the products that are used, I think, is helpful.
Okay, so I thought I saw some other questions. Yeah, Christine?
I have a question about sort of suppliers, and this became evident to us during COVID, but particulate matter, inorganic particulate matter, and differences in suppliers, and it's a very practical question. But how are you dealing with this? Have you noticed, I mean, we've noticed differences in suppliers and things, and how are you handling this with the FDA, or how is one thinking of handling this with the FDA as part of manufacturing, or have you noticed this?
Okay, so matter matters.
Are you referring to particulate matter?
Are you talking about like from bags?
Yeah, final product container you're thinking about.
Yeah, I think pretty much everyone would be probably aware of the recent untitled letter, about evidence of particulate, both organic and inorganic particulate matter. So it goes back to sort of the, you know, a couple of themes there, right? One is potentially a single source, because that vendor, in my experience, is sort of universally used across, multiple products. So that's one failure point that's going to affect multiple products. I know that they are working really hard to improve their quality systems in terms of visual inspections and so on. We do the same things on our end as part of incoming receipt to try and standardize the process to remove any affected material before it even enters the manufacturing process. And I think this is just part of the overall evolution of the field. As the general level of quality goes up, we'll see some of these and then we'll overcome them through, I think, fairly conventional means of, that's already been tackled in big pharma.
Yeah, this is a crazy topic for me. So I worked in MSCs early in my career, and we filled in bags, and we filled dozens of bags per batch, and we threw out 20% of those bags because of particulate matter. I think inherently the way these bags are made, there's so much static that it accumulates particulates. So I think that whole industry has to be revamped, one simple or is an allogeneic. We're doing vials. We don't want to fill hundreds of bags. And vials are much cleaner, so vials aren't a problem. And I know in autologous I've seen both vials and bags, but I think bags are more more convenient, I think, in the clinic, right? Why do we worry about these particulates? We went crazy at Celgene in the early days with our placental product that was this MSC-type product to try to understand the risk of these particulates. I don't think there's a risk. There's been studies in animals where they've injected hundreds of these types of particulates. It doesn't do a thing. So we're talking about patients who are going to die, and we're worried about a particulate? I think it's crazy, honestly. I'm not saying you're crazy. I'm saying the regulators. If they're, I don't know if they're really
we
hung up on this or not. I think they shouldn't be worried about this.
The FDA's asking us to put in a first test.
Yeah, you do it.
So
we need to educate the FDA. So Arvin's right. You want to look at the bags ahead of time. But we looked at bags ahead of time. We threw out half our bags. And then when we filled them with product, we found more particulates. We were thinking about doing a pre-fill with formulation media,
looking for particulates, emptying and then filling. That's how crazy we got, which was nuts. We didn't do it, luckily. That was nuts. I just think we have to educate the regulators.
The counter-argument is the burden is on the sponsor to show what's an extrinsic particle versus an intrinsic particle, right? And that the toxicity levels. But, you know, actually, I'm aware of at least one CAR-T process where sponsors actually used a 40-micron mesh as part of the final flow to de-risk that.
That's a lot to ask. Yeah, one quick question in the back there.
Hi. This is Leon Tang. So really fantastic conversation. Just like high level, so I realized that there are two parties on the panel actually have a strong collaboration, which is WuXi Advanced Therapy Unit and Iovance, right? So they help you bring your product to commercial stage. So could you comment from your, you know, obviously I guess you two are good friends, how you work from like, you know, CRD all the way to CMO, right? The CRDMO, right? It's RDM. I guess how that transition, how that, you know, work differently compared to a lot of big pharma. They are, you know, have a little bit more money to spend, so they can do a lot of things in-house, spend like a couple billion dollars, which probably is not so easy. So if you can share like some insights from that perspective, I think going to be very useful for a lot of biotech in CGT space, especially autologous CAR T, or like in your case, autologous your TIL, right? Thank you very much.
Arvind, you're a six-minute walk from WuXi.
So. Yeah. So one thing that really worked in our favor was we are essentially co-located. So Iovance's internal manufacturing site is in Navy Yard. It's literally next door to the WuXi QC building, and it's about a mile and a half from the manufacturing site. So that really enabled us from a tech transfer standpoint. You know, it enabled the shoulder to shoulder very easily. We didn't have to worry about, you know, logistics of people having to fly in and fly out and all of that. It was that became very seamless. But I think the key basis for this collaboration has to go back to really good communication that's set from the top down, you know, in terms of how the interactions are set up, you know, at the steering committee level, at the operational level, at the technician level, having the openness to, you know, talk through difficult items, because in any tech transfer, you're going to run into challenges, whether it's on the analytical side, the manufacturing side. You know, just having openness to saying, okay, we're in this together, we need to find what the root cause is. It's not finger-pointing, it's really trying to do what's best for the patient. Having that mindset and working through those difficult problems together, that I think was a key enabler to the success. Certainly the geographic co-location helped a lot.
Yeah, just one comment. It's been 7 years, so that's a strong marriage. So just put it this way. So we go through ups and downs, I think, together, and also share common goals. And another critical important is understand the limitations. We understand each other's strengths, but at the same time understand each other's limitations. So complementary to each other is very critical.
Okay. We're at time. We're over time. And I'd like to thank our panelists, thank the audience for the questions.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. For more information on the IO360 conference, editorial, podcasts, or webcasts, you can visit io360summit.com or theconferenceforum.org. Thanks for listening.